Politics is not always easy to describe. I mean, in some cases, it is easy to describe, as we can say, oh, that person is a conservative or a Republican, or we can describe ourselves as liberal. But this is where context creates complexity. If I say such and such person is a liberal, that has a differing meaning in Britain than it does in America. If I said to someone from Britain that a person was a liberal, the next question would be, do you mean a liberal Democrat or a liberal as in they vote Labour or Green? And to try and explain the differences to, say, a foreign listener would require me to explain some of the details about the history of said political groups and take on board how complicated local politics can be at times. And circumstances can cause people to change their political views. I myself have known lifelong Labour Party supporters who have voted Conservative, and very recently lifelong Conservative voters who've cast their votes for Labour. And to explain fully why this happens often requires going into what was going on in a country that influenced such choices at the time. We need to know the reason why people's politics change over the years. As it is in the 2020s, so it is in the 1360s. Like now, back then, people changed their political alliances. Like now, back then, the principal driver of such changes was often ongoing economics. The cost of living drove people politically, as did other issues. Back then as now, immigration and the impact of foreigners was a factor in our political choices, as was ongoing environmental and medical issues, as was the state of the government itself. Then, as now, these factors could create political fractures and the emergence of passionate political debates. I'd love to say that, unlike now, back then politics was often accompanied by widespread political violence. But given the current state of the world today, alas, we also understand that mechanism. And the idea that the residents of London in the 1360s could slip into violence because of their new political allegiances is not entirely alien to us. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the history of this great city in manageable chunks as we proceed chronologically throughout its tale. We have reached the second part of the 1360s, and after last week's episode where I focused on the big banner headlines of the city, of it regulating and trying to stay on top of things, this week we're going to go over some of those events again, but this time trying to explain what was going on behind the scenes, while we also move forward and try to see these events in context. This is a story about big economic factors that were to drive the political divisions to come, coupled with the third outbreak of the plague and a series of tragedies that were to impact upon England's all-powerful and majestic king. Welcome then to chapter 128 of The Story of London, Darkening Skies Over Westminster. Now, the economic and political issues in London during the 1360s were a tad complex and also, I'm afraid to say, a tad dry. But since when have I avoided boring listeners with the complex and political issues facing London? Sorry, not sorry. But I will try to simplify it to make it into a narrative that you can follow and understand. You may remember back in chapter 124, I went on in detail about the Grocers, the birth of the Grocers Company. An origin bound up in the Fraternity of St. Atheline, the quasi-formal group of ropers, spicers, dealers in woad and dyes and wool merchants based roughly over in Soper's Lane. And these had come together when the city lost its traditional rights and franchise over trade in the aftermath of the first outbreak of the plague. And during the 1360s, we have several things going on with this fraternity. One, the records of the fraternity are lost to us during this decade, partly due to just time, but we can also ascertain that the group started strong, then fragmented, and then regrouped, eventually becoming the formal Company of Grocers, the great livery company of grocers of London. The Fraternity of St. Athanine of the Pepperers of London fully transformed into the Grocers' Company, but the journey to get there was a bit complex and there were considerable changes in the structure as it went along. Back in 1352, wool merchants who had lost their rights to export wool due to the King's Edict took over leadership of the Fraternity, and they did so to protect their control of the distributive trade in dyes and alum, which they had moved into when they couldn't exploit wool. But in 1357, English merchants were again allowed to export wool, provided they paid the same customs as foreign merchants could. So those guys could keep on trading in dyes, but also get back into raw wool exports. The newly empowered wool merchants of London were ordered to take the wool to Bruges, which worked in the interests of the grocers, making it now possible for them to import Venetian and German goods from Bruges by exporting wool from London. The overseas staple remained at Bruges until 1362, and then it was moved to Calais, which was to help pay for the heavy costs of defending the town. The proximity of London to Calais meant that once again Londoners benefited most from this overseas staple, and once again a staple is just a name for a wool market. The Londoners' advantage was further increased in 1365 when permission was given for wool to be exported from the city's quays without the need for it to be first taken to the Westminster staple to be weighed. It's noticeable that while the English merchants were banned from the export trade, the mercers, for example John Francis and John Payer, had been prominent as the mayors of the Westminster staple. But once the trade was free, the grocers such as Roger Rota took over, and then Fulke Harwood was mayor of the staple from 1365 to 1369, and Fulke was a grocer. Also another grocer, Richard de Preston, became mayor of the Calais staple in 1365. With the staple at Calais and Bruges, London's grocers could once again hope to dominate the trade across the Channel. However, those years when those English merchants had been unable to export had changed the structure of the trade itself, strengthening the hold of the larger, richer members such as Fulke Harwood, who'd been able to bribe foreigners to take them into illicit partnerships. And the combination of men with lots of capital now being allowed to trade legally, well, London's grocers were exporting wool in enormous quantities on a scale not seen before in the city. The consequence was that ports up north, like Hull and Boston, lost in the 1360s more and more of the wool exports out to London. And the effect of this shift in trade, well, you saw that in York with the amount of credit being registered there from 1365. The North's economy now began to be impacted by the growth of London, and that fall was never really to be reversed. This is where London really began to become the main economic powerhouse and an engine of trade in Britain. Inevitably, many of the new wool merchants across the rest of England, who had just now been allowed to start exporting wool, they started exporting from London. And they would invest in grocery goods at Bruges to remit their profits coming home. And they would find it convenient to enter into partnerships with London's grocers so they could distribute their imports to the provinces and therefore raise the funds to make new purchases of wool. The visible prosperity of these rich merchants and the close links forged by the Bruges and Calais staples between the wool and grocery trades, unfortunately, coincided with another sharp rise in prices from 1361, after the second outbreak of the plague. As always, when prices went up, Parliament lashed out at different groups of people who they held responsible. And round about now, they were blaming the drapers who were demanding too high prices, they felt, the people who coveted luxurious clothes above their station, because that was forcing up the price. They were pissed off at vintners, profiteering from the increase in the sale of wine. They did not like a bunch of wool merchants in Calais imposing surcharges for their own benefit. They were furious at merchants and hostelers in ports and towns engrossing fish, wine, wax and spice and making huge profits on their sale. And finally, they were most furious at the, quote, merchants called grocers engrossing all manner of saleable goods, unquote. For Parliament, these English wool exporters were now importing loads of different things, which until recently had been imported by a whole bunch of different people. The remedy they demanded, and which the king granted, was that the merchants should be limited to one trade only. If you dealt in wine, that's all you could deal with. If you dealt in wool, that's all you can deal with. Parliament appointed surveyors to see that this was enforced, and then commissions of inquiry were made up to supervise the work of the surveyors. To be blunt, this was a kind of piece of legislation that was promoted by people who owned lots of farms and land, and had, you know, they didn't like town guilds, and it basically betrays they had no idea how mercantile economies work. Whatever the case, the statute was passed. Another huge blow upon London's newly emergent economy. What could London do? Well, their only hope was to, bribe the king by buying exemption from this law. And the various professions in London combined to raise £452.16 as a present to him in 1363. If you remember last episode, I mentioned all those presents being given to the king from all those London groups. This is why he and the King of France were being given gifts that year. It was a straight-up attempt to bribe, buy exemption from some seriously dumb laws. If you remember, the biggest contributors were from the drapers, the mercers, the fishmongers and the skinners, each of whom paid about £40 each, followed by the vintners, who paid a little over £33. If you also remember, mentioned it last episode, the grocers' contribution suggests they were, not very organised. You had £26.06.08 from the grocers themselves, £5 from the grocers in the ropery, £2 from a spicer called Adam Carlyle, 1 mark of silver from another spicer called Thomas de Grantham, and 10 shillings from an even different spicer called William Breckles. The total was almost equal to the amount the vintners were paying, but it's disparate across several sources and several places, and that does seem to suggest that in 1363 the fraternity wasn't really working, it was disintegrated. The basic theory is that despite the huge wealth being generated by some of the members, not all the members of the fraternity were on the same page. It seems that the apocryphes and the ropers had again moved away from the Soper's Lane men. The chief aim of the Spicers of Cheapside had always been to capture the raw market from the Italians. The increasing domination of the grocery trade by rich wool merchants can hardly have encouraged working spicers and ropers to suddenly start going, yeah, we like those guys in Soper's Lane. Unlike the drapers, the vintners and the fishmongers, it does appear that a dominant group amongst the grocers hadn't sought to bribe the king to get out of this stupid law. They had no need to do it, since the Calais staple gave them the only commercial privilege they required to dominate both their import and distributive trade. However, they could not escape the consequence upon city politics that had come to focus even more bitterly on the issue of the city's rights and franchise. Those professions and bodies who could not benefit from the overseas staple and could not afford to purchase their monopolistic rights from the crown saw the restoration of the rights of London as the only hope of safeguarding their trade against competition. A division was beginning to open up in the city, therefore, between the mercantile interests, whose stronger passions lay in the wool trade, and those like the mercers and drapers who could reap no advantage of an overseas bloody staple in Calais. The drapers had reacted to these circumstances by founding, round about 1361, something called the Fraternity of Our Lady of Bethlehem, through which they sought to control the sale of cloth in London. But the drapers' claim brought them into conflict with the cloth manufacturing professions who had ambitions to break into the wholesale trade. And this ties into another story I mentioned last episode, the tale of John de Hackford and Richard Hay, whereas the records of London and the way I told the story suggests there was a personal reason for the trial and suggests that it was a case of John de Hackford having his personal issues with Richard Hay. Closer reading of this event said that this was the backdrop to what was actually going on in their row. But the wild accusation of 10,000 men ready to kill the political establishment of London was actually part of this ongoing conflict between the likes of the drapers and the mercers and the grocers and others. Notice the professions of the two men, a tailor, aka someone who's aligned to one side, and a fuller who's aligned to the other side. One chronicler of the time, John of Reading, does refer to a conflict of London between maiores et populares, the better and the ordinary citizens. As we said last episode, John de Hackford was sentenced to spend a year and a day in jail, being bought out to the stocks every 3 months for public humiliation. But while the records of London say the king insisted upon this punishment, Hackford was released from prison early by royal order. There was more going on there. And we mentioned this footnote to the story we told last chapter, because when Hackford was released, he needed sureties. You know, people who would swear that John de Hackford would behave well and would never do that again. And one of the men named as standing for him was a draper called John de Northampton. This is the earliest mention of this man, but please do remember that name, as we'll be hearing a lot about him in the years to come. The basic impracticality of that stupid law that it restricted importers and exporters to one class of goods soon became obvious to any merchant and, well, soon became obvious to everybody else. Even the landed interests discovered after a year's experience that it only created monopolies and raised prices even more, and accordingly the dumb law was repealed. But even though this law was repealed, nobody was restoring the city's franchise, and the passions grew. While the retailing and manufacturing interests in the city were reduced to registering their ordinances and sheltering behind their fraternities in an attempt to exclude outsiders, the newly prosperous grocers were taking the opposite course. The fraternity expanded during the 1360s. Because of this, suddenly rising up to about 114 active members. But so great was the demand in the cloth trade for raw materials that the rich wool merchants who dominated the group saw no need to limit the numbers of newcomers to the trade. It appears that in the 1360s, the amount of credit the grocers gave their customers increased by 30%. A few surviving members of the original fraternity of St. Atheline continued to be active alongside all these newcomers, but more and more these newcomers, who had no obvious links with Soper's Lane and came into the grocery trade simply because they could import and export a range of goods, began to dominate. In 1365 to 66, only 11 men who called themselves grocers or who subsequently joined the grocers company appear in London's customs particulars exporting just wool. But it's interesting because, like, the 528 sacks and 6,062 fells exported by Hoke Farwood, and the colossal number by William Burritt of 338 sacks out of 1,419 sacks being exported by Nicholas Brembe, this is a man who is only known as a wool merchant and not yet as a grocer, probably conceal that there were numerous joint ventures and unnamed partners going on attached to that fraternity. The grocers were becoming a powerhouse unto themselves. And yeah, I did mention you do need to pay attention to that name, Nicholas Brembe. He was soon to be the champion of the grocers and the nemesis of John de Northampton. But it wasn't just grocers getting into the get-rich-quick atmosphere of the late 1360s. By 1365, it appears that the fishmongers exported more wool than any of the other crafts. The fishmongers, you see, had one of the most strongly organised professions to protect their monopoly. Moreover, they had the shipping to take the immediate advantage of the reopening of the wool trade to English merchants. This accounts for the partnership of well-established pepperer of Soper's Lane, William Breckles, entered in with the fishmonger John de Thusum. Another eminent fishmonger, John Lovkin, who became mayor in 1366, may have been the same man who joined the fraternity of St. Athanine in 1351 and 52 in the company of another wool merchant, Fulk Harwood. The grocers sought out the fishmongers as partners because they were slow to acquire ships of their own. And it wasn't just wool they were into importing. They also went after woad. The outbreak of the Hundred Years' War had caused the constant interruptions in the supply of woad from France. And the merchants from France who dominate the trade were for years excluded from going to English ports. English merchants, therefore, began to look for new supplies from the south, from the areas around Toulouse and from Gascony. Inevitably, London's vintners, who would occasionally suffer from being told they cannot ship any wine into the country, started to move into the woad business. Men such as Sir John Stodey, who had been accustomed to investing huge sums of money in wine imports, suddenly found themselves barred from the trade and saw woad as the best alternative. In these ways, the ever-growing demand of the cloth industry for dyes and other raw materials was drawing men from a variety of commercial backgrounds into the profession of grocers, and the dye trade itself focused increasingly on London. The great expansion of the grocers had clearly undermined the control formerly exercised by the old fraternity of St. Atheline, and the mayor left the grocery trade for a few years with little formal organisation. There are signs, though, by 1365 that those who were in the trade began to close ranks. On the 20th of November that year, the Ministry of Grocers, Pepperers and Apothecaries elected six surveyors from Soper's Lane and two each from the Ropery, Cheapside and Bucklesbury. Three of the Soper's Lane men who had chosen as surveyors had been members of the Fraternity of St. Atheline, and all of them, and John Young, the new Keeper of the Balance, had shops in Soper's Lane and were rooted in that community. What's interesting is there are two men who were coming in from the group in Bucklesbury. Without going into a lot of detail, and trust me, we could go into a lot of detail, Bucklesbury was basically where the Italian merchants had been based, including people like John Donnet, an Italian-born apothecary who was granted citizenship at the King's request on the grounds that he had lived in London since he was young. And around Bucklesbury, you now had a new group of people who were once rivals now joining with the fraternity in order to maintain control over their newly grown business. Why should the fraternity suddenly start to elect surveyors? Their election in district geographical groups from Soper's Lane, the Ropery Chief from Bucklesbury, and the inclusion amongst the numbers of hitherto unknown ropers as well as Italians makes it clear they were nothing to do with the old fraternity. Their election appears to be part of some movement which had caused the Vinters, the Fushmongers and the Drapers to buy letters patent from the King, and also lend their weavers, cutlers and others to bid for crown support in the summer of 1365. All those regulations we saw last chapter were part of the ongoing backdrop of workers in the city and businessmen in the city trying to stay one step ahead of all their rivals, be they foreign or from just out of town. The movement amongst professions of London to organise and control their members gained strength from the same fears which had inspired them back in the 1350s. Or in other words, last episode, if I gave the impression that all those rules and regulations on London was being caused from a top-down approach, the mayor wanted to regulate all those businesses, what was actually going on? It was coming from the bottom up. It was all the businesses and professions saying to the mayor, we need you to regulate things. And these issues were beginning to come together to shape the city's politics in the next decade. The rivalries within the cloth trade were already in 1365, bringing to the fore the draper John de Northampton, who was to become the enemy of Nicholas Brenby and the Grocers' Company. In 1361, Northampton had been chosen as an upholder of the drapers, the equivalent of one of the surveyors, and he and a fellow draper, William Essex, were most prominent in the drapers' campaign to bring the fullers, the cleaners of wool, under their control. In 1364, Essex scored a success for the drapers, causing a fuller to be fined heavily for bad workmanship. And this led to violence between the fullers and the drapers. And during that fight, John de Northampton was bound over to keep the peace. But unfortunately, the drapers were unable to control the cloth making and monopolise the sale of cloth because the mayor and the aldermen had previously decided that the fullers and the weavers should be allowed to elect their own surveyors. And the effect of this was to give these separate groups separate power bases. It became clear to the drapers that they could only hope to reverse this decision and realise their ambitions to control the cloth trade by creating a sufficiently strong party favourable to their interests on the Court of Aldermen. If this could not be achieved by normal political methods, well, then there was a possibility of building up a similar political alliance in the Common Council. It was hoped that popular resentment against the foreigners and the enemies of the franchise could be exploited by the drapers, John de Northampton and William Essex began to plan such strategies by making themselves leaders of a reinvigorated campaign to recover the franchise of London. The franchise became a more bitter issue in 1365 because foreign imports suddenly went through the roof. Although the English share of the import trade rose with the return of the wood staple in Calais, foreign imports kept on increasing, the demand of raw materials of the cloth industry kept on just rising, and by 1365, foreign imports had gone up by 30%. This was because from October 1363, the Italians were taxed on any wool they sent by Flanders to Italy. When from 1365 onwards, Edward III started selling licenses which allowed them to bypass this tax, so they didn't have to go first to Calais, they had a double incentive to export their wool directly from London. The result was they greatly increased the amount of goods they were bringing in so they could pay for more wool. And these imports were principally of mercuries and groceries. As a consequence, less bullion came into the mint, so that between 1365 and 1369, London moved into a considerable contraction of its economy. And as always, when times became harder and their trade contracted, the disparate elements in the grocery trade responded by joining together to protect their interests. And so this was why you started seeing the fraternity steadily supporting surveyors, and this was going on in the background. The fraternity had almost fallen apart when times were good, but now times were bad, they suddenly needed the fraternity of St. Atheline again. Within a few months, the, quote, masters and others of the mystery of grocers, unquote, brought additional pressure on the mayor and the aldermen to ban 12 foreigners, mostly Italians and one Englishman, for acting as brokers in the city. In 1368, they joined together to present their own choice of brokers to the mayor and aldermen. By controlling the brokers and using political pressure on the city's government, they hoped to beat off the Italian competition. Other professions were even more aggressive in their attitude towards the Italians. Yet, with all things, there was stuff going on nationally that was impacting on London. See, foreign trade brought higher customs duties to the Royal Exchequer, and it provided the possibility of substantial loans and gave the king a powerful diplomatic weapon. It was therefore all the more necessary to protect it, just as the king was contemplating a new war with France. And yes, the war was starting again, and we're going to cover that in a moment. In the pursuit of his conquest in France, Italian sea power and Italian money meant more to Edward III than the trading interests of the city of London. As a prelude to the declaration of war that was just about to happen, the king announced the abolition of the Calais staple and a renewal of the ban of London residents exporting wool. This threat of the renewal of war and of the king's favour to the Italians threatened everything they'd just gained over the last decade. Their export and import trade was going to be taken from them. In June 1369, the thoughts of the young and more hot-headed elements amongst the grocers were turning in the same direction as the more radical elements of other professions. And towards an alliance with a group of mercers and drapers who were ready to stir up violence on the streets of the city in their campaign for London to recover its franchise. And at the head of this group was the figure of John de Northampton. To this, the more sober and cautious grocers saw the need to reject violence, and what was needed was more effective organisation, and they had come to realise they needed to act just as quick. Simply put, a new chapter was beginning in the history of the politics of London, and also of the grocers. But right in the heart of this, along came a third outbreak of the plague. Now, the Animal Chronicle, written in St. Mary in York, said that, quote, in 1369, there was a third pestilence in England and several other countries. It was great beyond measure, lasted a long time, was particularly fatal to children, unquote. And a chronicle written in King's Lynn also repeats 1369, at the year in which, quote, there occurred a great pestilence of nobles and children, unquote. However, the Chronicle of Peterborough describes how the third pestilence actually began in 1368. Amongst the dead was a great number of foreigners, they said, living in London. The evidence provided by the Hustings wills and the wills provided in the Archdeaconry Court of London demonstrate that actually the plague broke out in the south of England from about May 1368. Probably faded out in London round about October that year, but it did spread into the next year across to the rest of the country, which is why we have the alternative dates. The third outbreak probably began in London in late April or early May, and was evidently of sufficient severity for King Edward to completely suspend the business of the King's Bench, the Common Pleas and the Upper Exchequer on the 22nd of May until the 30th of September. The Exchequer of Receipt, altar based in Westminster Palace, did stay open but conducted business on only 3 days during this period. Significantly, the King had pressed ahead with his Parliament on Westminster between the 1st and 21st of May, indicating that the business to be discussed was really, really important, or the disease was not considered to be as bad as the previous outbreaks. It may have been the latter, but we aren't too sure. Amidst this activity are the inevitable guardianships hearings for children orphaned from the death of a father or of both their parents because of the Black Death. The earliest example during the outbreak was held on the 4th of May and concerned Alice, 7-year-old daughter of Nicholas de Peckham. Alice appeared in a custody hearing just 1 month later, since one of her relatives to whom she had been assigned to had by then himself died. Other similar cases highlight other plague deaths. An orphan called Joanna, aged 8, daughter of Walter de Herodon, was committed to William de Herodon, her uncle, on the 13th of July. Sureties of her were paid by 3 men, including Thomas Wybie, who himself succumbed to the plague that year. The draper Thomas de Walford had died during the 1361 outbreak, leaving his estate to his wife and his children, John, Elizabeth and Johanna. Between his death and 1368, both John and Elizabeth had also died, leaving the last child, Johanna, the sole beneficiary, under the guardianship of somebody called Michael Edie. On the 3rd of July, 1368, Michael brought Johanna to the Guildhall, handing her and her property into trust. 3 weeks later, she was committed to a new guardian, a draper called Richard de Klingworth, but within a few weeks, she was also dead. By June, we know from evidence found up in Derby that much of England was in the grip of the disease by this date. July seems to be a particularly grim month. We see in the list of wills from the rich men of London a sudden spike. One was for John Lovkin, the man whose term of mayor had spanned the first great outbreak of the plague and had gone on to be mayor 3 more times until his death, sometime before November 1368. Another was for the Chandler, William Heatherford. There was one for Robert Fookes of Gaddesby, a tailor and citizen of London, dated on the 18th of July. He requested burial in Holy Trinity, besides Robert, his uncle, and left 20 shillings to the box of the tailor's fraternity of his trade. The fact that the outbreak was happening in the summer once again received complaints about the dangers surrounding animal slaughter and butchery in and around the city. On the 3rd of July, the new mayor, Simon de Morden, and his aldermen received a writ from Edward III, enclosing a complaint that had been made by no less than the Bishop of London, the Earls of Warwick and Salisbury, the Countess of Pembroke, and other residents of Old Dean's Lane. And they alleged that the butchers of the shambles near Greyfriars, quote, who used to slaughter their cattle and leave their offal and refuse outside the city, had recently taken to slaughtering within the city, carrying the offal and offensive refuse by day and by night through Alderness Lane and by the King's Wardrobe to a small plot by the Thames close to the Friars' Preachers, to the grievous corruption of the water, unquote. The writ demanded that this practice be stopped. The mayor initiated an inquest covering 4 wards, Castle Baynard, Farringdon Without, Vintry and Queenhithe, to discover the extent of the problem of disposing offal and waste in the Thames, and the extent to which people considered it a real nuisance. A jury of 12 men from Castle Baynard Ward found that it was indeed the Shambles butchers who carted their offal to a place called Butcher's Bridge near Baynard's Castle. And not only was it polluting the river, but blood from slaughter yards and offal dropped from the carts fouled the streets and lanes. It was once again recommended that all slaughter of animals should take place beyond the city walls. And still, this plague continued. Will-making in August was still at an elevated rate. Amongst them, we see William de Burton, a goldsmith, who drew up his will on the 31st. His wife was disposing of his property 4 weeks after this date. Pepperer John de Evenfield included in his will a rather curious stipulation. Quote, his body was not to be left above ground, but to be placed in a chest underground and to be previously covered in about 10 ells of black or russet cloth, unquote. Why he wished this treatment and how it may have differed from other standard funerals, we don't know. But it does suggest he did not wish a period of watch or wake over his body, either at his home or in the church. He willed that he be buried in the church of St. Mary Aldenbury next to his first wife. Burial space appears not to have been an issue during this outbreak, despite the fact that the emergency cemetery at East Smithfield had certainly gone out of use by this date. There is a reference to the enlargement of the cemetery of St. Leonard Eastcheap in this year, but it seems somewhat haphazard and rather underscores the sense that this version of the plague was less severe than the previous two. The plague victims were varied, and their wills grant us insights into the complexity of their lives. One I liked was John Deniers, who died before September the 1st, and his son Henry. Henry, choosing not to pass his inheritance on to his stepmother, John's second wife, instead bequeathed the proceeds of his will to the maintenance of a clock on the Church of St. Pancras, a new belfry at St. Mark and Margaret Lothbury, and the maintenance of six scholars up in Oxford. Such were the winners and losers during this pandemic. It's clear, however, that by the end of October, the pestilence had passed on. The impact of the third outbreak of the plague is hard to gauge on London. While we'll never know for sure, the figures do suggest a mortality rate of about 11%. What was all this doing to the population of London? Well, even if we allow a speculative idea that the population of London roughly increased 2% each year, and that we go that as a guesstimate that the resident population of London was about 34,000 in 1361, and by 1368 it was about 39,000. This suggests that after this outbreak the population fell again to about 35,000 by the end of that year in the beginning of 1369. The impact upon London was probably wide-ranging, but still, the city persevered. And it came at the end of a decade that had been very taxing to the king himself. At the beginning of 1362, Edward was in his 50th year, heading for a birthday that would bring up a personal jubilee. This was a significant milestone. With it came the unavoidable awareness that he was entering old age. Although 50 barely seems middle-aged to us today, it was somewhat over the hill by the standards of medieval aristocrats. The one thing that does come out in the years leading up to his birthday was Edward's strategy of giving out his sons positions of dignity and responsibility. Edward, the Prince of Wales, was given the title of Prince of Aquitaine, becoming the resident ruler of that province. His second son, Lionel, was to start up with inheriting basically Ireland and running it on behalf of the king. His third son, John of Gaunt, was to be given lordship of the north of England. Clearly, Edward's idea was to create a series of lesser kings under his sovereignty, and rather being a king who ruled only a prince and a dozen or so earls, he would be a king who ruled over several dukes and a prince, just as King John had ruled over the dukes of Normandy, Burgundy, Brittany, and Orleans. Edward's eldest son, the Black Prince, the Prince of Wales, had long been marked down for duty in Gascony, ever since that first campaign when the Gascons had actually requested him. With his wife, he had set out to his new domain, where he arrived, having spent the whole winter before in Cornwall, and his administration of the duchy began well there. He instituted a hearth tax, and a high one at that, which should have been very difficult to impose on an area which was famous for evading paying taxes. The fact that this controversial measure was accepted throughout the principality shows that, well, he started well. But his autocratic manner, however, did not endear him greatly to the subjects he was ruling, and he personally went on to alienate a number of Gascon lords. He didn't have the administrative or negotiating abilities of his father. Edward the Black Prince was a paradoxical figure. He was brilliant in battle, but useless in diplomacy. He comes across as having the best martial talents of Edward I and Edward III, but the autocratic attitude and diplomatic skills of Edward II. Meanwhile, Edward's third son, John of Gaunt, was destined to run the north, and he secured the inheritance of his wife Blanche, one of the two daughters of the late Duke of Lancaster. But then in 1362, his inheritance doubled with the unexpected death of his sister-in-law Maud. This meant that all of the huge Palatinate lordship of the Duchy of Lancaster, the richest land in England, passed to John of Gaunt. King Edward hadn't expected this to happen, and it's possible he viewed it as unfortunate, because it gave John even more land than his older brother Lionel. Added to that, John of Gaunt was the kind of man who made enemies for life. Still, these were his sons, and they were shaping up to be a pivotal force in the governments in the year to come. And then he finally celebrated his 50th birthday. To mark the occasion, he summoned a parliament, almost entirely consisting of commoners, and he issued a general pardon to wrongdoers throughout the realm in commemoration of his jubilee. That parliament is today remembered for one piece of legislation about all others. Quote, "Pleas shall be pleaded in the English tongue and enrolled in Latin," unquote. This was the first piece of legislation which officially recognised the English language. Since the 11th century, the language of the nobility had been French, and the language of the courts had generally been French, translated into Latin for permanent record. But this new legislation now recognised it was not right that men and women should be tried in a tongue they did not understand. But its significance was more than just fairness. The Statute of Pleading, as it was called, gave official recognition to the language of the English. It described it as the tongue of the country, and it's from here that it was accorded the status of a national language. In doing this, King Edward recognised that a great change was taking place. Whereas in 1200, almost no one of importance in England spoke English, it being very definitely the language of the peasants, by 1400, almost everyone of importance did speak English. Edward himself spoke it and used it in his mottos. Duke of Lancaster spoke it. Edward's grandson, Edward of York, went on to translate books into English. In 1362, John Wycliffe, the man who first translated the New Testament into English, was the master of Balliol College. His opponent, the gifted Simon Langham, abbot of Westminster and Archbishop of Canterbury from 66 onwards, spoke English. Chaucer, the first great poet since Saxon times, was to write in the English language, and he was in royal service. English was coming to the fore, and one of the reasons for its speedy rise was its patronage and use by eminent men, including the king's ministers and members of the English royal family. Anyway, that's why the parliament's remembered, but it's also worth remembering on the day of his birthday, Edward promoted his second, third and fourth sons to new high titles. Lionel became the Duke of Clarence, in reference to his inheritance of his Clare estates. John became the Duke of Lancaster, acquiring the title of Edward's late general, and Edmund became the Earl of Cambridge. And of course, then he held a great feast. On his 50th birthday, Edward revelled in his stupendous fortune by sharing a little of it out amongst his children, his friends, and his people. And yet, as the decade wore on, this autumnal zenith of the king, his ambitions became more modest. The sudden decline of ambition may be attributed to his age or his changing nature, but we should also consider his state of health. We believe, although it's not easy to prove, that Edward began to suffer declines in his health. I mean, the regularity of royal tournaments may be considered one of the checks. Jousts continued to take part, but whereas in 1348 there'd been a royal tournament every month, now it was rare for him to hold more than two a year. Edward was not just resting on his laurels, he was preparing to retire on them. He usually confined his movements to the area of the Thames, travelling by royal barge. Now, one of the reasons for this mode of transport was probably his own declining health, and another was Queen Philippa's medical issues. It's obvious that she had hurt herself while falling from a horse when she was out hunting with Edward in the summer of 1358, and it appears she was making preparations for her death as early as 1362. By 1366, the king's own health took a turn for the worse, and payments were made for an apothecary by the king's physician for medicines for him. But mostly he was spending his time recovering and looking after his wife, Queen Philippa. Throughout the 1360s, however, not just in the plague years, Edward also began to lose those close to him. His sister Joan died in September 1362, 2 months before his jubilee. His daughter-in-law, Elizabeth, Lionel's wife, died the following year. His companion, Knights of the Garter, died with slight regularity. The men who'd come to take their places were all young, nearly 30 years younger than Edward. They were promoted because of their inheritance. As the king walked around his newly completed masterworks of Windsor and Sheen, he must have been saddened that the friends with whom he had laughed with and jested with and had been there when he ordered these buildings' constructions were now gone, replaced by younger men which he had little personal affinity with. The most significant death of this period was that of King John of France in 1364. The king had returned back to England in January because his ransom had not been paid. But upon returning, he then fell mortally ill. And that was a problem for Edward, because not only was none of the ransom now going to come, John had not formally renounced sovereignty over the agreed territories he'd made before he died. That finickety part of the peace process had never been properly ratified. And the responsibility for renouncing these territories to give to England now fell to the Dauphin, who became Charles V. Charles had proved reluctant to, well, give anything, and as such, any hope of a formal reconciliation and permanent settlement was extinguished. The great victory of Edward III was about to fade away like smoke in the wind. Renewed war seemed certain. And it came from an unexpected direction. I could go into huge details about the campaign of Castilia, but basically, Castilia in northern Spain agreed to be allies of the English. The French supported somebody to go against the Castilian king, and they toppled him. Nearby in Gascony, the Black Prince then gathered up an army, moved into Castilia, and absolutely beat the living snot out of them, because that's what the Black Prince did in battle. But in doing that, he had a problem. He didn't gain back the monies he had spent on this war in Castilia. And not only could he not reward the Gascony lords who had come with him to win this great victory, they are now stuck with a huge tax bill to pay for the massive gap in the Black Prince's finances. As such, the lords of Gascony took one look and suddenly started wondering, maybe we should swear allegiance to the much more timid and not as broke King of France. Yep, it was the Najera campaign of the Black Prince that basically kick-started the Hundred Years' War again. When the local Gascons wrote to Charles in May 1368, appealing against the taxes imposed by the Black Prince, the French king saw an opportunity to divide and rule in Gascony. King Edward was old, and he was ill, and he'd lost his companions in arms, and more importantly, his queen Philippa was dying. And he was determined, even with this going on, to stay with her to the end. Edward attended Parliament reluctantly in May 1368. Rather than discuss the deep crisis his son was facing in France, he showered praise on the representatives, he passed laws that had no clear strategy, he seemed to be avoiding anything difficult. The only acknowledgement of the impending doom appears to have been the statute abolishing the wool staple in Calais. And it was after that Parliament that the gravity of the situation became clear. That November, when the new King Charles of France assumed his sovereign role, he demanded that the Black Prince appear in Paris in May 1369 to do homage. Edward wrote to his son. War was clearly now coming, but the reply he got back was even worse. The Prince of Wales, Edward the Black Prince, was seriously poorly. When news of the prince's illness reached England, it was just another blow to the old king, who was now psychologically crushed by the events of the year. In addition to his and Philippa's own sicknesses, in September he had heard the death of his daughter-in-law Blanche, the last surviving child of the late Duke of Lancaster and the wife of John of Gaunt. Such news, coming on top of the realisation that war was now imminent and the illness of his glorious son, with whom he'd been so proud, was utterly dispiriting for Edward. And then worse news arrived. Prince Lionel was dead. Lionel, his second son, named after his Arthurian hero, probably the most intelligent of all his boys. Where would this end? Lionel had been over in Italy. He'd just had a glorious marriage to the daughter of the Lord of Milan. and now he was dead. Messengers were coming from Italy asking where Edward wanted his son buried. King Edward had great difficulty coping with so many disasters. Old and sick, he dismissed many members of the royal household. Expenditure on the royal buildings almost completely ceased. Any money available would be needed for war. The great palaces of state became silent, like memorials of his great victories. At Windsor, the winter sun of Christmas 1368 shone upon a sad space. Servants' steps rang out as they crossed empty rooms. The clock chimed in the round tower. Nothing could prepare Edward for his loss of health, children and friends, this loneliness. He still had his pride, he still had his throne, and he still had his responsibilities, and slowly his mind turned towards the oncoming war. But despite this personal frailty, Edward began forming a strategy by which he could once again take on his enemies. The Earls of Cambridge and Pembroke and the Lord of Powis were among many lords dispatched to the Prince of Wales. Archers were selected in their counties. Men were arraigned in the town. Stores were ordered to be dug for siege engines. And Parliament was summoned to Westminster. On the 3rd of June, Edward asked the Parliament for its views on the prospects of a war. The MPs responded unanimously that they believed Edward should resume the title of King of France and make war on Charles de Valois. Preparations began to gather momentum. Taxation for the forthcoming war was agreed by Parliament. He seized the revenues of foreign monasteries in England. John of Gaunt was sent to Calais. It was expected that the army would follow him there, but the army did not follow because in mid-July, Edward received a message from Queen Philippa. She wanted him near her. They both knew this was a death. Philippa lingered for a few days in Windsor. Edward suspended the invasion of France while he waited for her, and then on the 15th of August she died. Edward and their youngest son, Thomas of Woodstock, were with her at the end. He had not just lost a queen. Philippa had been his oldest and closest and most trusted companion. Outside his rain-splattered windows, across the grey-covered land of England, it had been the worst harvest for half a century. And it was in this atmosphere that reports were coming to him that the plague had returned for a third time. And that November, on the day of his 57th birthday, plague killed his own friend, the Earl of Warwick. Edward had outlived almost all his friends and companions in arms. All six of the earls created so joyously and proudly in 1337 were dead. His mother, his father, his sisters and brothers were all dead. His daughters Mary, Margaret and Joan were dead, and his son Lionel. He had buried three other children in infancy. All those who had wished him a long life had unwittingly wished on him the most cruel of fates. To be a man who lived his entire life in the company of friends, children and great men, and to watch them die. Edward prepared for Queen Philippa's funeral with loving care. He could not face leaving an army himself and sent his own retinue across to Calais to join John of Gaunt. But John was more worried about his father than France and was back in England by mid-December, spending Christmas with him. The darkening skies above Westminster promised trouble. Great storms were about to break above England. And that's that. Hope you could follow it. An episode of three parts. Be moving on with the story next week. There may well be, I cannot promise, next week's episode is due out because we're coming up to Christmas. So I'll let you know. It will be out next week, but I'm not too sure if it'll be Wednesday. Okay, thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Bye.